Hey, everybody. Josh Sheridan here with the Barely Legal Podcast. They demand my alter ego, but I won't go. Because on today's show, we have, and tell me if I'm getting the name right, Rena Upshaw Frazier, because the last name I've seen kind of differently depending on how it's being advertised. Is that what you're going by?
You are spot on. Okay, I go by Rena Frazier. My legal name is Rena Upshaw Frazier.
But then I was watching a clip on the news and there was another name in there. Was there a Kelly or something like that? Or
no.
I don't know. So I know you. And I mean, obviously we're friends on Facebook and we've had every reason to cross paths with each other, but I can't really put it down to one thing. When did you start it in law school?
So I was in law school from 2001 to 2004.
Okay. So then we would have had about a year where we overlapped. So I started in 99 and graduated in 2002. So then my third year, we would have been there at the same time. So okay. I'm sure I remember you from there. Then did you go right into corporate or did you do state attorney for a while?
No, I was with, I went straight to private practice with a large firm. Okay. I didn't go to the state attorney's office until 2016, I believe it was. 2016.
Oh, really? That recent? Mm-hmm. Okay. And was that in Hillsborough or Pinellas or where?
Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office.
Okay. So then I crossed your paths there some way, shape, or form. Well, kind of going back to the beginning, you're a Tampa Bay native?
Born and raised. Old Seminole Heights is where I grew up.
Oh, so I mean, my office is in Tampa Heights. I'm just blocks from probably where'd you go to high school?
Hillsborough High School.
Okay. And was it a big family, a lot of siblings, or just you, or how did?
Two of us. I have a brother and a sister. My mom is still in the house we grew up in.
Oh, wow. And where did you fall in the line of three kids? Oldest, youngest, middle?
I'm the oldest.
Okay. So
responsible, I like to say.
So the younger two got away with murder after you kind of, you know, you had to live it with your parents.
They did. They're going to be so mad that I said that, but they absolutely did.
And are you all still close? Everybody still here locally?
Everybody's local. My brother travels a lot. He does welding. My sister's in North Carolina doing really well. So we do keep in contact. My mom and dad are fortunately still here, and they're both local in Tampa and out in closer to Brandon where I live.
What do they do for career?
They both worked for the post office.
And oh,
both
really?
Retired. They did.
So I know you went to USF for college. And in high school, were you in sports at all? What kind of kid were you in high school?
Oh, goodness. Not sports. I played the violin.
Oh, really?
I did.
Oh, very cool.
I tried out for cheerleading and didn't make it. So whatever that's worth.
Probably better off. Yeah.
I was a very serious student though. So I did, a lot of the honors and AP classes in high school. I played flag football when I got to law school.
So did my wife. My wife almost got kicked out of flag football. She was serious. She had plays written up, and I don't know if it happened while you were there, but in the beginning, they would put kegs out there for us to drink while we were playing. And then they got rid of them because everybody was like getting into fights and stuff.
We still had them when we played. That's how serious it was. We had kegs out there. And
well, do you remember? My recollection was, you know, all these people that are in law school, so they're already like tweaked to argue with everybody about everything. And they would get into these huge rows with each other. And I'm like, none of you are elite athletes. You're in law school playing an after school sport. So just dial down the excitement, just a scotch. But yeah, they would get after it. But so violin, could you read sheet music and all that stuff?
What was that?
With the violin, could you read sheet music? Did you get that deep into it?
I was pretty good. I stopped playing when I got a little bit more into high school. And I used to take the bus to school and honestly just didn't want to lug the violin with me anymore, which is so unfortunate, not a real reason to stop playing. But I was pretty good at the time. I couldn't do it now to save my life. Maybe I could relearn it, but it's been a while.
Was there music in the family? Was there other people who played or?
No, I mean, no more than anyone else's family. We used to watch, you know, MTV or what was it? The box, I think it was, where you had to, you could select your music. Mm-hmm. No, my kids now are much more musically inclined. I mean, my daughter sings, is in a musical theater. My other daughter plays the guitar. I have one that's learning drums. So it's, I think it's important and it makes you well-rounded. Music, oh, right. Art, I think all of that.
Definitely stimulates a part of the brain that doesn't otherwise get stimulated in day-to-day life. So USF, was that kind of where you knew you wanted to go, or were you kind of trying to decide whether you wanted to go out of state and stay in state, or how did you end up there?
I actually had my first daughter before I graduated high school.
Okay.
And had planned on going out of state for college and ended up needing my support system here. So I did early decision to the University of South Florida, which okay. ended up being a really great fit for me.
And as far as law goes, did you have attorneys in the family? Was that something you knew you wanted to do when you went into college, or did that come later?
No, my dad, who worked at the post office, his initial intent was to go to law school.
Okay.
And I think he actually went for a semester, ended up not finishing it, coming back home. And so he told me about that. And so that was kind of something I wanted to take up, maybe just in honor of him going to law school. Didn't have any experience with it. Hadn't done an internship, which I wish I had, to be honest.
Would it have changed your mind? Would you have gone down a different path? Yeah,
possibly. But yeah. But it all worked out well.
And how was your time in college? Did you do any extracurriculars there? Was it pretty much just study and being a mom?
Definitely a lot of studying, being a mom. I worked in the environmental engineering lab, loved doing that. So I would go on.
Did you end up getting a degree in that? I think I
did. Yeah, okay. I did environmental engineering. Yep.
And what put you down that path?
Just auditing some classes, sat okay. in on different classes. And I think I originally wanted to be a scientist. And my dad was like, what kind of money are you going to make being a scientist?
You know, I was a philosophy major and I had a similar conversation with my yes. parents.
Well, I acquiesced and was like, okay. So I figured environmental engineering might be something that I'd be interested in.
And did you go right from college into law school, or did you take some time off and try some other stuff?
Went straight to law school. I actually did an internship with an engineering firm and realized that it probably wasn't a career I wanted to go into. I loved the schoolwork, wasn't crazy about the actual work. It was just a lot of permitting and everything before you actually got to the fun design work. And then, you know, remember the conversations I used to have with my dad about him wanting to be an attorney. I was like, well, maybe that's a good path for me. And right. applied at Stetson and got in.
So did you start fall, spring, or summer?
I started in the fall.
Okay. So I started fall 99, you were fall 2001. Yes. How was it? Now, did you have any more children between your first and when you started law school?
I had my second 2 days after the bar exam.
Oh, wow. So,
yep.
Wow. You know how to load it on yourself.
I did.
Well, as you know, my recollection, and I'd be interested in your experience, is a lot of the students who are coming to it as a second career or students who had kids were much better motivated than those that didn't. You know, there was a little bit less partying, a little bit less, you know, kind of dating and all that. Others, you know, people either came to it with a career background or had a kid is like, I gotta make it happen. I don't have time to be screwing around with all this other stuff. Was that your experience?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Those who had, you know, they kind of discourage you from working your first year in law
school. Let us work our first year.
A lot of us, right. I mean, some of us had to, you know, because
sure.
Just to, you know, live. And I think working, having children and all of that really made you put your head down and serious. I mean, it's that first year is really tough. I'm sure you remember.
I remember it very well. And, you know, I remember those finals, the first round of finals just being, I could have either booked this class or flunked it. I have no idea what I did.
And it could have went either way.
Right? Yeah. Who did you have for property? Did you have Wilson or Brown?
I had Wilson.
I wish I had Wilson. I had
a football coach as well for our team. It was called Indecent Property.
So. Which, oh, geez. I wish I had him. I had J.J. Brown, who's the old guy in the wheelchair. It was just mean as hell. But, I still wake up every now and again in the middle of the night thinking I slept through my final, or, you know, those law school nightmares never completely go away. Now, while you're in law school, I think you just mentioned, did you do moot court or law review or trial team or any of that stuff?
I did trial team.
Okay. Was it Karen that was the coach still, or who was the coach at the time?
Pam Cole Bell.
Yes. She was towards the end of my time. I actually went to Chicago with her. So I was on trial team when like Theodopoulos and Carl Mitchell and all those people were. I don't know if you remember them. I think Joel Elsay around your time.
Who was that?
Joel Elsay. He was on trial team, and he was at the state attorney's office in Hillsboro.
That name doesn't ring a bell.
He's a good looking guy. You remember him if you saw him. He's
okay.
I always thought it was unfair that he was good looking and smart and all these other things. So, so where did you get to do a lot of competitions?
Oh yeah. We were ranked. I think at the time our school was ranked number one in advocacy. We would win national competitions. I got best oral advocate in a national competition. And our team had came in second. I got best oral advocate. We had a really, really fantastic team.
Was that something you knew about yourself before you tried out about it? Did you know that you were comfortable, or is that something that kind of happened in law school?
That actually happened in law school.
Yeah.
Just trying out for it. I did do that. We had a moot court competition. I think Gray Robinson moot court competition. I had done that 1 year and did really well at that. And just discovered that I, you know, kind of enjoyed thinking on my feet and was always a big preparer. So I would prepare really, really big for the competitions and just worked out really well. So I discovered that at the school.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, looking back on it through the lens of my career since then as a prosecutor, you know, I would be walking into court reading criminal report affidavits the morning of trial, like who do we have as witnesses? And then I remember back to trial team where it's literally like punctuation and which tense are we using and which pronoun are we using? It's like maybe somewhere in the world people are preparing to that level for trials, but it's not happening at the state attorney's office or the public defender's office.
It's so different. I mean, it is worlds different just from, you know, being at the large law firm representing clients in these big cases, the amount of preparation that goes into it. And then the absolute phenomenal, I call it public service work that our state attorneys and our public defenders do, carrying such a volume of cases that they carry with, you know, the time they have, you can't possibly devote the time that you would have in private practice to it. And they just do such a phenomenal job.
Absolutely. Now, where did you intern while you were in law school, or did you?
I did. I did a judicial intern with Judge Scriven, Mary Scriven, who was on the federal bench.
Is that related to Brian Scriven?
Her husband is Lance Scriven.
I think Lance and Brian, maybe. I know Lance, but I think, anyway, Brian's a friend of mine. And he's actually been on the podcast, and I think I asked him this question, and now I'm blanking.
Okay.
Whether or not there's a relationship, but in any event. How was that?
Miles Taylor and Grace as well, which was a workers' comp firm.
Oh, that's fun times. How was it working for a judge?
I learned so much. I still feel like I consider her and her husband. I ended up working at a firm with Lance for a few years. We were at Quarles and Brady as mentors. It was just eye-opening to see the judicial part of practicing law.
Right.
And you know, just getting to help with, you know, drafting orders and sitting in on some of her, the cases that came before her. It was a great experience.
So how did you decide where you went to work? Was it because of your internships, or what was that process like?
Part of it were the practice groups that they offered, and part of it was money. I'm not going to lie.
Was it a billable model? Were you having to do billables? Yeah.
Of course. Yes. It was a billable hour model. And, if Fowler White, which is no longer a firm, they were acquired by another firm not too long ago, but, I ended up doing an internship there my last year. And that's where I ended up going to work right after law school.
And how many years were you there?
I was there for 6 years. I left the year before I would be up for partner.
Oh, wow. That's did you know? I guess you would have known that at that time. So it was, you know, you're not going to be able to make me an offer that's going to keep me here type of situation.
It was, and I worked for a fantastic attorney, a supervising attorney who was just a great mentor. I just needed a change, and I ended up going from there to a national firm that a friend of mine was working at and just thought it was a fantastic firm.
At that time, 2009, 2010?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. And so with the national firm, were you stationed in Florida, or did you move around, or what, how did that work?
It was a national firm that had just opened a Tampa office. So they were trying to staff their Tampa office. When I transferred, I was at a time when I was approaching burnout and wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in law. And so I needed the change of environment and the change in firm to see if that's what it was.
Well, it's funny, and I don't know if you noted this, but probably is a lot of the top percentile of the classes, they get these amazing jobs at these amazing firms. And they go in and they do it for a period of time, but then they get burnt out and then they go back and work for the public defender, or they go back and do these other things. Tom Townsend, who was the number one in my class at the time, he's in public defender's office up in the panhandle after going through the mill. And it's kind of interesting how that works. I mean, I guess some people stick it out, but it's just tough. So
we get this idea in our heads that, you really are going to change the world. And I'm not saying you're not, because you are. What we do as attorneys is so important. But I think you get to a point where you realize the money isn't enough to sustain you. You know what I mean? To have a fulfilling life. And so you need something else there.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, you had at least two kids by that point, right? So you were at least somewhat grounded in that world. I mean, I think I'm not one of these people that think everybody should have a kid, that parenting is for everybody. But I do think that having children really kind of opens up this whole other part of your experience of life, your brain, kind of the way that you approach things, the way that you think about things. And it does kind of, at least for me, and I wouldn't be surprised if it were the same for you, that what's important to you changes with children. So although it's nice to be able to afford tuition and afford diapers and afford all this other stuff that, you know, all the toys that they want and tablets and all this other stuff. So then you did another 6 years with the national firm. Was it the same type of law or was it different?
Same type of law. It was, I had done a year of securities litigation at my first firm and then transitioned into.
Oh, that makes my brain hurt. Securities. Oh gosh. Okay. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I hear securities and it sends me reeling. So you hear that.
And so when I went to the other firm, then I was doing real estate litigation and business litigation.
Which kind of was fortuitous, because it seems like that might have been a bridge to kind of finding yourself where you're at right now. I mean, was Absolutely. That part of it?
One of my favorite quotes is from Steve Jobs, and he says, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You kind of have to look back, and when you're moving forward, just trust that whatever you believe in, the universe, karma, God, whatever it is kind of leading you on the right path. And that's kind of what it was. I enjoyed real estate. It felt tangible. It felt real to me. But I couldn't have scripted this journey that would take me through real estate law to real estate agent to a Netflix reality show based on real estate. At the time I was getting involved in these areas of law.
So when are we now in the timeline, like 2014, 2015, when do you start doing the real estate? I'm trying to line it up with where the market's at in that given year.
I started doing real estate. I did 1 year of securities and then jumped into real estate. So if I started in 2004 at the firm, then I got into real estate in 2005 before the market crashed.
Oh, so you were, I thought real estate was just after you switched to the national firm. You were doing it back at the first firm.
Yes.
So you lived all through 2008 and 2009. Yes. Well, tell me about that. That had to be surreal.
Here's the beautiful thing about real estate is that it's cyclical. When you have a great market, you have these deals that are going on, you've got title easement, all kinds of development projects and things that are happening. And when the market tanks, you're not out of work, but you're just doing work.
Just new issues. Yeah.
You probably don't find as glamorous. You're doing evictions. You're doing, you know, if you represent banks, you might be doing foreclosures. You're renegotiating contracts for clients. So you always have work as a real estate attorney. It's just the type of work you have is dependent on the market. I was not as keen about the work when the market wasn't good. That can be heart-wrenching. I know you kind of need to take the emotion out of it as an attorney and do the best you can for your client, but some of that work is tough emotionally to do.
And was it commercial or residential or both?
Namely commercial. If we had like a large residential portfolio, we would work on that as well.
Okay. So then back to the national firm, you're doing real estate there as well?
Yeah. And then general business disputes.
Okay. And so when is it that you start to, the seed gets planted to get a broker's license, get a real estate license, do all that? I mean, is it seeing the fortunes that are won and lost in that world, or what's the math that got you there?
It was a little less direct. I was still struggling with whether law was for me in the long term, and was up for partner. Actually hired a business coach to help me make partner because you've got all of those political dynamics happening at the firm. I made partner, and I remember my mentor telling me, you're really trying hard to make partner. I just want you to really understand when you make partner, it's not this thing that you think is going to happen where it's like, whoa, you've made it. Here's a drink, right. Sit back, kick your feet up. And he was right. It was, very much okay. Now let's develop more business. Let's feed associates. Let's market for the firm. On top of keeping your billable
caseload, yeah,
keeping your case on your billables up. And I ended up running for office.
Oh, really?
I did.
I'm sure I'm aware of that. I mean, I kind of feel like you're always in the conscious somehow. You're kind of. Just they're always kind of there. So what did you run for? What was it for?
State representative.
Oh, wow. Okay.
My area in Brandon. I had actually challenged an incumbent. It was a seat that the state party had targeted to flip. Mm-hmm. And I had kind of was in the business community and was born and raised in the area. So boy, that was a once in a lifetime experience.
I can only imagine. And Brandon too, because Brandon's such a weird community. My wife is from Brandon. Her father was everybody's orthodontist in Brandon. Basically Orthodontics was on campus.
Oh, yes. I'm very familiar with
that. Yeah. And so like everybody from Brandon's like, yeah, your dad did my braces or your dad did my whatever. But it's really... with Fishhawk and some of these other areas, there's kind of developing into a younger atmosphere, but there's also kind of this very Southern, if you get my drift, type of contingent there. And so, I would wonder what obstacles that would have put in place for you running over there.
Long ago, Brandon was very rural and conservative. And,
I have to drive to court in Dade City. I have to drive to court in Marion County, and I see all these Rick Perry signs and all the last 10 elections, every Republican candidate that you could see. And I mean, even just recently, I had to drive to Citrus County, and there was billboards about Biden stealing the election and all this other stuff. And it's funny because you don't have to drive that long to kind of be in another world as far as a worldview and political. I mean, not to mention just next door, I'm sure there's people with that worldview, but. So how did you find that? Did you have to do the whole campaign thing? Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Fundraising.
You're a glutton. You were a glutton between law school and running for office. And all you like to put a challenge in front of you.
Well, the policy aspect of it was important to me. Right. And I'm always up for any type of life changing experience. You get one shot at life. So. But the fundraising, the door knocking, the campaigning, the going to events, the whole game. I mean, we ran a very full professional campaign. And I had a primary, and we won the primary and lost in the general. And that was in 2016.
And were you still practicing then too?
I was, but after the primary, between the primary and the general, I couldn't say I was practicing a lot. And my firm was fantastic. I had to get permission to run. I had to write a memo to the board, because the main thing is, one, if you win, they want to make sure that, you know, we don't have any lobbying clients or something that is going to, you know, cause a conflict. And two, they just, you know, they want to make sure that you are still going to be a practicing attorney. And state representative is, they say it's a part-time job. You know, you're in Tallahassee for like 3 months out of the year, but it's probably a little more than part-time.
Sure. That loss, how did it land? Was it heartbreaking? Were you kind of okay with it? I mean, how did that impact you?
I was probably more impacted than I thought I would be, because you kind of get tough skin when you do trial work. But the hardest part for me was I had these fantastic students from USF that were busting their butts. They were going out every weekend. They were knocking doors. I had people who were writing me letters like, "We're so glad you're running." I'm a Black woman, you know, running for office, and you know, in Brandon, challenging an incumbent. And so the hardest part was feeling like I had let all those people down. That really got to me. And
right,
you know, that was tough.
It doesn't sound to me like you've done a whole lot of losing in your life either. I mean, you probably, most things that you put your mind to have prevailed. So, you know, it's hard to, what's that?
Except cheerleading.
Well, that, and arguably that was that one left the deeper cut on you. Yeah. So that's funny. So then after 2016, when do you start kind of changing path or kind of, you know, getting to where you're at right now?
I mean, if you can imagine coming off of running a campaign, you're just out all the time. I went back to the office, and it was tough just being in an office all day. And I had gotten a call from the brand new state attorney who had won his race, and asked if I would be interested in applying for a position there.
Has Andrew Warren been a state attorney since 2016?
Yes, he has.
God, it seems like it was yesterday. Okay. So I would have told you that was 2020. I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Well, that's cool. So yeah. Did you know him prior, or how did you two connect?
Met him campaigning. We were both first time.
Oh, you were running at the same time.
We were running at the same time. Oh, so we were at a lot of the same, you know, circles, campaign events. And I think we were very supportive of each other.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, I came up in Pinellas County as a state attorney, so I wasn't quite as knowledgeable of the Hillsborough County politics until I started practicing here more around 2010. But, you know, Ober was such a masthead for that office, just like Bernie McCabe over in Pinellas. I remember when he had a challenger, I was like, that's not, nothing's going to happen there. It's just a waste of time. And, you know, when he won, I was like, oh, that's kind of crazy. And now we've got, since Bernie McCabe passed, there's a female challenger running against Bruce Bartlett over there. And she's been on the podcast. I don't remember the numbers, but it's like I think a woman has never run over there for state attorney, and a Democrat hasn't challenged anybody over there since like the 60s or something like that. And she also told me that Pinellas County is the number one county in all of Florida for incarcerating the people in prison in Florida, which doesn't surprise me. I didn't know that fact, but it kind of made sense when I heard it, just having worked over there. And it's like, well, we don't dismiss anything, everything good, you know, but so that's interesting. So yeah, so Andrew Warren, so you only knew Warren as a boss working over there. Because if I recall, when he came on, there was a lot of people that were kind of Ober, you know, connected that kind of left when that happened. So, okay. Well, that's probably why you didn't know Joel Olsay, because he probably left right around that time, maybe for that reason. I don't know. So how many years were you there?
I was there for about a year and a half. I came in to do policy. I was the public information officer. I was the chief of policy and communication, which was somewhat of a new position that had combined several roles and did community outreach, which hadn't been really a position at the office before.
Were you there for the shooter here in Seminole Heights, Tampa Heights?
I was.
That was so I bought the building that I'm in, which is about a mile north of the Stetson Tampa campus on Tampa Street. You've probably driven past it coming from your parents' house, but when I bought the building, we had a hurricane that was headed straight for Tampa, and like the courthouses were closed. And then we had that kid that was running around shooting folks. And I was like, I may have just made the worst decision in my life buying this building, because first off, it's going to get knocked over by a hurricane. And second, none of my clients will come here because these people are getting shot. And then they built Armature Works and have developed all these huge buildings and the property values. So it ended up being okay, but I was, it was scary. That was such a bizarre case. You may not even be able to talk too much about it, but I mean, that was such a weird case. And if you were involved in public policy and information, you were probably doing a lot with that, because that was right when he came in.
There was a lot of I was the public information officer at the time. So there was a lot of communication with law enforcement, because at the time it was still in law enforcement, law enforcement was working the case. And it was just such the only word I can think of is just interesting time. I mean, everyone was afraid. Everyone was hopeful that this person would be caught. What a time to be at the state attorney's office.
Well, he came in and right off the bat, he got a handful of big time media cases. And it was just like, whoa, you're going to have to you don't get any time to rest and kind of get comfortable. You got to, start figuring stuff out right away. But so I taught this last semester at UT, I taught criminal procedure and criminal law. And the class project that I gave the students was on serial killers. And so we spent a lot of time having speakers come in. I had Lori Chain, who represented Bobby Joe Long and Eileen Warnos, and some Bjorn Brunvon, who represented serial killers. So a bunch of these people had come in, but we spent some time talking about that case, because so much of that didn't make sense. First off, there's just not a lot of black serial killers. So that's number one. Number two, a lot of them don't use firearms. Number three, the victims weren't the same. And a lot of times, the thrill of it and somehow appeals to them. And he was kind of doing it from far away and then running off. He wasn't, so it just was like, I'd be interested, people who spent time on it, but it just seemed to defy so many of the things that we know about
serial killers. I think that's such a tough case as well to crack.
Then the parents, that whole thing was kind of weird. And I know that they were wanting to prosecute them. I haven't super followed it since then, so I don't really know where it's at. But I remember they were wanting the parents to come in and talk, and they wouldn't talk. And then I think they might have even brought charges against the parents, or at least threatened to, and just crazy stuff. And during the semester, we had the laundry case, the guy who killed his fiance and then disappeared, and they found his remains in the— Do you remember?
I don't recall that one.
Well, again, it was
or Pinellas.
No, it was inside, like Manatee, Sarasota, or something like that. But again, they were trying to get the parents to come in and give them information. And as a parent, I'm like, what would I do in that situation?
I know it's really tough.
So you weren't in a courtroom; you were kind of more operation side of it.
I was an admin. I was sworn in as an ASA, but I operated in the admin realm.
So when do we get to real estate again? Like where your current space?
It had gotten so I was there for about a year and a half, and learned so much, had a great experience, but I was so far outside of what I typically do, right? I wasn't practicing law. I wasn't in real estate, and kind of had this issue I had to work out with myself is, am I following the path that I want to take to get to where I want to get to in life? And am I going to stay in politics? If so, this is a great, Or am I going to stay in, in policy or in communication? This is great. If not, how do I get to where I want to go? And, it was around that time that my neighbor, who was Sherelle Rosado, who's now my broker.
You guys, I wasn't sure if that, Well, I guess I knew you worked there before that show got pitched, so I guess you would have known each other. But that was a question I was going to get to, is how much of the makeup of that show was set up for that show and how much of it existed beforehand?
None of it. It all existed.
Oh, it did. Oh, okay.
She was in the military at the time, had gotten her license.
Paratrooper or something, right?
Yeah, she was. I don't know the term for it, but she jumped out of planes, out of some type of training where she was jumping out of planes. And so she was a real estate agent part time. And she was like, you should get your real estate license. You're a natural. You'd love this. And so I did. I decided I was going to get my real estate license and start working as an agent, and to transition into that. I opened my own firm. I left the state attorney's office, opened my own firm, so I could do some legal work while I was transitioning into real estate agent.
What type of work were you doing in that firm? Was it real estate as well, or?
It was what I was, bread and butter. It was, sure, you know, beefing disputes, helping clients with contracts, real estate deals. I did a little bit of land use, just kind of whatever came in the door.
Sure. And then, so now as you're working with that law firm, are you working with a lawyer as a real estate agent, or did you just kind of do independent stuff? Because now I owned a title company for a minute, but I was kind of partners with the people who knew what they were doing. But as a real estate agent, you have to have your license through a broker. How does that work?
Yeah, you get your license, you have to, what I call, park it with a broker. So you have to be working under a broker until you get a broker's license. And so when I first got my license, Sherelle had not opened her own brokerage. So I had it parked at another brokerage because I wasn't actually operating as an agent yet. I just had my license. And, you know, as an attorney, you don't have to take all the pre-licensing courses. You can just study and go take the state licensing exam.
Right. Well, that's kind of the shortcut into the title company thing. And so my partners were realtors. I was the attorney. I grew up in St. Pete in Tampa, so I knew all the people. And I was like, oh, this is going to be easy money running a title company. We did it for, I think they might still be doing it, but we did it for about a year and a half. And I was like, these clients are more needy than my divorce clients are. Like, you know, this didn't post yet. Did you send the money to this person? Did you do that? I was like, forget about it. You guys can deal with that. But, So what the broker that you parked it with first, was it a bigger firm or was it a smaller independent firm or?
It was a more established, probably mid-sized broker. No, I wouldn't say mid-sized. It was a small brokerage, had been established for a little while, were some individuals that we had known in the business community. And so I wasn't a full-time agent at the time. And so I was thankful that they let me have my license there. And basically I was a referral agent at the time.
Right. And then at some point you go over to Allure. I mean,
Sherelle comes and talks to me and tells me that once she's retiring out of the military and that she's going to open her own brokerage. And so as soon as she opened her brokerage, I ported my license over to her brokerage and started working in real estate full time.
Was there any idea of the show existing at that point?
None. That this was at the end of 2019. The show wasn't even on the horizon. All the agents you see on the show, we were there working as real realtors, just, you know, building up the company when the show came along.
So when did the show come along? Like, when did that first become a thing that, hey, this might happen, or they're talking about doing this? Like,
so the brokerage started at the end of 2019. I'm going to say, probably maybe midway through 2020, Sherelle actually, a producer had reached out to Sherelle because of social media. She'd put out some pictures of the agents and, you know, there's this woman owned, women of color brokerage, that's kind of starting up in Tampa. And once that producer reached out, I think she started realizing, like, okay, this could be a real thing. She actually reached out herself proactively via Instagram to the producers of Selling Sunset and said, are you guys interested? We have some other interest here. And they were interested.
Wow. So when that happened, did that just kind of change the temperature in the room of kind of how things were getting done? I mean, it seems, I don't see how under that magnifying glass, even if it's just a small you know, look at what your day-to-day life is, that people are talking to each other differently, dressing differently, maybe, you know, could you tell that it was going to change how that firm ran?
I will say it was such a long, it felt like a long discussion. I mean, we had so many interviews. They had to figure out whether there would be a network that would pick it up to, you know, was Netflix interested, because you have to have a network that's going to stream it.
Was Sunset on Bravo, or what was selling Sunset on?
Netflix.
It was? Okay. For some reason, I don't know. So I used to watch all these shows avidly with my wife before we had kids, but I'm the parent who puts the kids to bed. So I get my son down, and then I get my daughter down, and then I pass out. So I don't get to watch these shows. Every now and again, I'll tap back into Million Dollar Listing or, you know, whatever these things are with my wife. But she's now like 10 seasons of experience where I'm still remembering like the first generation of all these people. So anyway, let me see if I can ask this politically. You have such a wealth of experience in very kind of high level professional jobs, whereas I didn't get the sense, you know, Sherelle aside, military, but you just had such a long experience with conflict, professional things, that it seems to me it would be hard for you or difficult for you to kind of involve yourself in some of the infighting or some of the arguments that you might see on the show, because you just have such a different perspective on it. I mean, was that something that was like, I've got to like kind of not go all in on these little petty arguments? Was that something that was an internal monologue, or?
It was actually a tough decision, whether to be involved in the show, because we didn't have to, right? All of the agents didn't have to be involved in the show. Because what I didn't really watch a lot of reality TV to begin with, but my impression was that I didn't see a lot of people that were like me or that had my background or even my personality. And I'm like, is that even really entertaining, right? Do people really want to watch what I do? Or do I have to change who I am to be entertaining enough? That I wasn't interested in doing. And right. So when I did the interviews for it, I just was very careful, just make sure to be who I was, so that, you know, they knew what they were getting with me, if that makes sense. It was one of the things that was very important to us, was that there was this positive depiction of Black women and of professionals in this space. And we really wanted that to be depicted. And that was very important to me. I know it was very important to Sherelle as well. And that was something that we kind of emphasized up front. And so that's kind of why we all decided to go into it. And that's why I decided to go into it. And like I said before, at the end of the day, it was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And, you know, how do you not take that opportunity?
Well, I'm assuming you know her, but maybe not if you remember her, but Dana Santana, who's a friend of mine and went to school with you, and she works in this space too. She's just, you know, she said it best. She's like, Rena's always been a rock star. Just wherever she's at, she's just kind of her virtue and value and personality just kind of shine through. And it's funny, and I usually don't prep much for these podcasts, because most of the time I know I follow more avidly what it is that I'm talking to the people. But I did watch this with my wife, and I watched a lot of the wrap ups. And you know, most of the wrap ups, you're the fan favorite. Like, and people really, I mean, you know, I won't denigrate anybody, but there's a couple people that they mention, like filler, and then they get to you, and they really, you know, talk, you know, classy and all these different things. So you were successful in doing what you set out to do. And as far as the show goes, if you know, I don't know what zero would be, but if 10 is like Housewives of New Jersey, where people are like flipping over tables and everything, you guys kept it pretty professional. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of that storyline with Alexis and then showing back up at the finale and that kind of stuff. But in the pantheon of what happens on some of these shows, it stayed pretty you know, pretty respectable. So I think that was awesome. Do you guys know yet if there's a season two? I mean, is that, if that's a secret, that's okay. But
we honestly do not know yet. I want to go back and just say one, Dana's amazing. Sure. Dana is such a phenomenal person. And
I just closed on my refi yesterday at my office and she was here. So you're a fan of them. And then, you know, we had an SBA that we had to do a refi and an SBA loan. So it was the two different loan. It was a nightmare. And there was a couple times there where I think she was ready to kick me to the curb, but yesterday it was all hugs and smiles. So
what you said, with, you know, the range of, you know, housewives to whatever on the scale, what I loved about the show and our role in it was that a lot of the disputes you saw were business related disputes. We're not, you know, you're not seeing anybody fight over somebody's man and things of that nature, right? It was really disputes that you would probably see in other businesses. I know what I see a lot, you take the good with the bad, right? And you said like, oh, they're, you know, you're one of the fan favorites. I also see the other comments about, oh, you know, when I was recruiting Colony and Anne, and, you know, you come in from the legal field. I mean, that's something, it is not unusual to see a group of people from a firm split off and go to, you know, start their own firm. And that's because
all the time in law firms, and I'm sure all the time in real estate firms. And I mean, if you take any snapshot over a period of time in those professions, this is something that happens all the time. So sure.
Absolutely. You just don't see the inner workings of it. You don't get to see the conversations that are happening, but you get to see that here because we let the cameras in. And right. So that was really neat to be able to, you know, kind of show that side of the business world.
Well, I did watch the final episode and you're present at the party. So it seems as though Allure is intact towards the end of the season. I don't know what's transpired since the cameras got turned off, but I checked your LinkedIn and I still see Allure there. So is that
you'll have to, crossing my fingers, we get a season two.
Well, you guys were the number one ranked show on Netflix there like the first week, right?
We were number one in the US, and that was for TV. And then when you combine it with movies, we were number three. So that's throwing in movies. And then we were highly ranked in other countries too. It was internationally broadcast.
Well, I mean, so the Tampa market right now is bananas. And I was talking to Dana about this yesterday, and she was talking about how much out of state and out of country buyers are now buying here. So I wonder if, you know, my wife and I, we go down to Anna Maria Island every summer, and we were lucky enough to get a beach house down there, but literally like all of our neighbors are German, you know, so there's so many, you know, people from other countries that are coming here and buying. And I was having this conversation with her yesterday about the market. And I said, what do I do if I want to upsize, if I want to get a bigger house, because I could sell my house for a good chunk of money, but I'm going to lose it all on purchasing something else. So, and I can't go rent for 2 years and wait for the bubble to pop because the rental market is nuts too. So, I mean, one of the things that I saw on some of the reviews is they mentioned up, they said, we don't actually see houses getting sold on this show. So I wonder, was that just because they weren't getting shown that much? Or I mean, I imagine things were getting sold during the filming of the show.
They definitely were. We had, I mean, on the show itself, the first house I was showing, which was the $1 million house in Water Chase, that one was sold. I talked about going under contract to the cash buyer. What you didn't see was the actual closing itself. But that one did close. Sherelle closed on the house in Miami for the Mayol Organics couple that owns that. And then there were a lot of closings that happened in between there. But as we say on the show, you know, we just started in 2019. We are just starting to get into the luxury market. And so you're seeing the growing pains of us trying to get into that market and us kind of making our way through there. So a lot of the closings that we had were not, you know, the other agents had may not have been on the $1 million price point homes, which aren't being shown on the show, right? Because the show is about like the glamorous real estate part of it.
Right. And, you know, that was kind of my assumption watching it is a lot of these closings you probably don't want to watch or hear about. So, you know, they're having to kind of parse out what is entertainment worthy and what is kind of more minutia that's just kind of going through. So you mentioned kind of, and I, if we got about 10 more minutes, if that's okay, I know you're busy, but I'm going to try and stop right at 4 on the dot. I don't want to take up too much of your time. So you mentioned kind of the conversation before you guys started filming that we want to do justice, you know, as a firm that's women of color and all these other things. As far as the clientele, have you seen a loyalty there? Like, I personally do family law. My partner, Marie Shobe, does personal injury and property insurance. But some of my tenants, I had a lot of Latino tenants that were attorneys that were working. And that was such a loyal, the Latino community really wanting Latino attorneys. That was a big thing. And, you know, I've got other friends from different cultures and there's that loyalty there. Have you noticed that with your firm? I mean, is there, you know, are you guys getting hired for that reason? Do you think, or what's been your experience?
Our clientele has been mixed. I mean, we just get, you know, from all different ethnicities and walks of life. We do have a good number of Black clients that hire us as well. In the luxury space though, it's just for historical reasons and everything that we can, you know, get into at another time. Our community, our the Black and Brown community has not really had the opportunity and has been kept out of really the real estate space for so long that we haven't had the opportunity to build up the generational wealth that a lot of other, ethnicities have had. And so, you know, as we get into that space, not all of our clients are going to look like us, because there aren't as many of us in that space yet. I feel like that's starting to change, but it's just, we're not there yet. And
I would love to, if you're ever interested, have a second conversation on that topic, because, you know, that's something I spent a lot of time on with my students at UT. You know, I made them all watch that documentary 13th about,
so good.
And just kind of, you don't realize, I have this conversation all the time, and we talked politics, and I kind of wanted to bring it back to that for a minute. But, you know, as far along as I thought we had come during the Obama presidency, when we get into the 2016 election and everything else that comes thereafter, you know, I don't live it every day. So my knowledge of it is what I see on TV, what I hear anecdotally. But you start to see, oh, wait a second, there's this whole other side out there. This still exists and is very prevalent. So it's interesting what you're saying to me, and it doesn't surprise me about kind of the generation.
Do you remember the story that came out about the couple that had the appraisal done, where they had pictures in their house and they were a Black couple, and the appraisal had come in so low, and then they ordered another appraisal and took the pictures down, and it was, you know, went up instrumentally higher. There are a lot of intangible things that you work through, not only for yourself, but as a realtor for your clients, that, you really just really want to kind of even the playing field and make sure they're getting the best experience possible.
I always joke, we live on Inner Bay and Ballast Point Bay. And so the two roads, if you're getting to our house, you can either go down Bayshore or you can go down MacDill. Okay. And I always joke, you know, when the property appraiser comes to our house, I want him to come down Bayshore. When the tax guy comes to our house, I want him to come down MacDill, because you're in two different parts of the world, depending on what street you're coming down to get to our house. So kind of where I wanted to kind of land with this is who you are, your name recognition, your brand is very different now in 2022 than it was in 2016. Is there a thought of politics again? Is there, you know, a judge? You mentioned where you wanted to be. I mean, have we identified those aspirations yet? Do we know what that's going to look like?
I do, loosely. One thing about having done the show is that it just kind of opens things up. And I kind of went through this moment of paralyzation. I was talking to a friend, and she was like, you know, Rena, just let the yarn unravel as it does. And I'm such a planner and trying to, you know, figure out, well, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do with this? I probably won't go back to law. In its pure
well played.
Form.
Good on you. Yeah.
Law. Politics, I feel, is so important, mainly because it permeates everything that we do. It's going to affect my children and their children. And so that's always going to be important to me. I've found other ways to be involved, just like I'm on the HART board and being involved with healthcare issues and transportation, that I find really fulfilling and able to make a difference that way. If I were ever to run again, I told myself that I wanted to be independently wealthy before I did it, so that I didn't have to, you know, fundraise essentially and rely on campaign contributions.
I hear you. I mean, when I started this podcast, I got the idea to start interviewing all the people running for judge. And, you know, it's hard to ask for money. It's hard to ask people for things because it's just not in our nature. And, you know, you get this kind of film that you feel on you of, you know, sorry, I have to do this, but it's just the reality. It's what you got to do, but it's tough. I always say that because we built the house that we're in, we built our house. And I was like, if we ever build another house, I want part of my language, fuck you money. I want to be able to just build that house, go stay in a nice condo, not worry about selling this house, have no timeline that I need to be on, because that was a nightmare. And the builder that we used wasn't like a Mobley or something where it's like, you can have A, B, or C. It was literally like, where do you want this switch? Where do you want this plug? Where do you want this thing?
Oh, and, wow. Super custom.
I got such exhaustion from making decisions. Like, I don't give a shit. Just put it somewhere. I don't care. Just put it somewhere. And now it's funny. My wife walks around. It's like, this plug makes no sense here. This light switch makes no sense here. You have to reach around the door to turn on the lights for the garage and all this other stuff. So now we know better. But anyway, well, I can't thank you enough for taking your time. I know how busy you are and how things are booming. I think it's super cool what you're doing. I really do personally, you know, selfishly hope that you do get into politics, because, you know, I look at people like Stacey Abrams and some of these other people, and I just think Florida is on a fence right now and could really go in two directions. And, you know, I'm hoping it doesn't keep going the direction it has been going in so far. So I would love it if you threw your hat back in the ring. And if you do, please reach out. I'll hold signs for you. I'll put you on podcast, whatever I can do, with whatever little megaphone I have, I'll definitely scream it from the rooftops. But thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. And I feel like we're in good hands. I think we're getting where we need to go.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Rena. Have a nice day.
Thank you for having me on. It was fun.
All right.